It just seemed unbelievable that this would be taking place or be allowed without special permitting and safety considerations.
The environmental review process for a large gold mine in interior Alaska comes under scrutiny. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 26th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, the State Education Board considers barring trans girls from girls' sports.
I've seen a lot of speculation, but there has not really been a documented wave of transgender athletes dominating any sport.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
The State Board of Education heard nearly 3 hours of public testimony today over a regulation to limit high school girls' sports in Alaska to athletes assigned female at birth. About two-thirds of the testimony was against the regulation. The board did not take action on the proposal and tabled the item to be taken up at a later meeting. Board Chair James Field said another meeting should be held to answer any additional questions.
Trying to create an excellent education for every student every day when you have a conflict in the middle of it, trying to navigate that needle isn't easy. So I think we're at the point where we need to take a little bit extra time.
Ahead of the meeting, the board received over 1,400 pages of public testimony. Kuba Gjenda is a runner and coaches high school and college athletes in Fairbanks. He told the board he opposes the regulation.
You know, I've seen a lot of speculation and what-if scenarios, but there has not really been a documented wave of transgender athletes dominating any sport at any level across the world.
Melinda Lindstedt of Juno said she was in favor of the proposal and would support creating a third category for trans and gender nonconforming student athletes instead of allowing them to compete with boys or girls.
There are reasons that male and female divisions were initially developed, namely safety and fairness. We are here to have as even a playing field as possible for all of our children.
The regulation would change athletics for all Alaska school districts except the Mat-Su School District, where a ban on trans athletes passed in June of last year. Meanwhile, an Anchorage man who pasted swastika stickers at several locations around the city in 2021 was sentenced to 18 months in prison on Tuesday. He was convicted in federal court on two acts of hate-motivated property damage and one drug trafficking offense. According to the Alaska U.S. Attorney's Office, 28-year-old Luke Foster placed swastika stickers with the text, "We are everywhere," at eight locations around Anchorage in May 2021, including the Anchorage Jewish Museum and the gay nightclub Mad Myrna's. Foster carved a swastika in the door of the Jewish Museum a few months later. Rabbi Yosef Greenberg, president of the museum board, says he's noticed an uptick in threats against the Jewish community in the last decade.
It's very sad when you see young people who are misguided and don't understand the danger of being influenced by the fear of the other.
Greenberg says he was encouraged by an apology statement Foster made during proceedings, saying his actions were wrong and hoped to learn from the experience. Federal agents initially caught Foster on drug charges after he was found using social media to sell psilocybin mushrooms. While executing a search warrant, agents found, quote, Nazi-inspired imagery, including a box of swastika stickers, in Foster's home, according to a news release. The state of Alaska is appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court to resurrect the proposed Pebble Mine in the headwaters of Bristol Bay. The state attorney general, with the help of a private law firm on contract today, asked the Supreme Court to repeal a January decision by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that in essence vetoed the mine. Pebble would be a massive open-pit copper and gold mine on state land. The deposit is located upstream from Bristol Bay, Alaska's most productive sockeye salmon fishery. The company hoping to develop it, Pebble Limited Partners, partnership says their mine design would ensure contaminants don't degrade the fishery. The state argues that the EPA, quote, confiscated state property and created a de facto national park. It's asking the court to either toss the agency's decision or order the government to compensate the state for the property. A coalition of tribes and fishermen who have fought the mine say the state is engaging in legal antics to help the Pebble Partnership. The Supreme Court is not obligated to take up the case. Meanwhile, reports about the health of Alaska's wild salmon runs seem to contradict each other. The population of prized Chinook or king salmon is in terrible decline all over the state. Meanwhile, sockeye or reds are having another banner year in Bristol Bay and everywhere. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin asked fish scientists why these two salmon species face such different fortunes.
University of Washington ecologist Daniel Schindler is at the mouth of a salmon stream near Lake Nurka in southwest Alaska. It's roiling with fish.
They sort of pile up in balls of thousands of fish for a couple weeks, and I think that's when they're doing their final maturation. They're jostling with each other and splashing and occasionally jumping.
Schindler is on his 27th year of fieldwork studying Bristol Bay sockeye. He says salmon abundance this year is on par with what Bristol Bay has seen in the last decade, and it's far higher than the historical average.
We tend to think of climate warming as bad news for wild animals, but for sockeye in Bristol Bay, warming has been good news.
Sockeye use lakes as their nurseries. Since the 1980s, the water in those lakes has warmed significantly. The warmth stimulates plankton to reproduce more, and young sockeye eat plankton. 50 years ago, Schindler says, a lot of sockeye spent 2 years in Lake Nurka before heading out to sea.
Now they grow so fast that nearly all of them leave after a single year in freshwater, which is a reflection of the fact that the freshwater systems have become more productive.
The science is a little murkier about what happens in the ocean, but Schindler says northern parts of the coastal ocean have been especially good for Alaska sockeye. More food, fewer predators. Chinook salmon aren't so lucky. Talk to a Chinook expert and you realize there are a lot of unknowns, but ocean and river changes have not been kind to kings, especially for those from Alaska's longest river, the Yukon.
It's kind of this perfect storm of bad things happening for those particular Chinook stocks.
Katie Howard is a state fisheries scientist. Her research shows Yukon Chinook who spawn during a warm water year produce fewer juveniles.
They're cold water fish. They can't really tolerate those temperatures very well.
Heat stress is just one factor. There's a parasite that leaves Yukon Chinook riddled with pus pockets. And there's evidence that female Chinook may not be getting nutrients they need in their ocean diet. All of these things may stem from climate change, and kings are particularly vulnerable.
Kings tend to spawn in really big rivers. That's where the big king populations are.
Eric Shane is a fisheries biologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says the Yukon, for instance, has all kinds of conditions along its 2,000 miles, but every fish that spawns there has to go through the lower river.
So if that lower main stem is unfavorable, or if the Bering Sea just went through a heat wave and they have to make it into the lower main stem with less gas in the tank than they need to swim 1,000 miles plus, then they're in trouble.
By comparison, the sockeye population of Bristol Bay thrives in the ocean, and they have multiple shorter rivers to climb with more cool spots to take refuge in. The Kuskokwim, like the Yukon, is a big river enduring a multi-year crash of Chinook. But there's more sockeye returning to it than ever before. So the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission is encouraging subsistence fishermen to take up dip nets to scoop up sockeye without hurting Kuskokwim Chinook. It's not a traditional tool for the region. The Fish Commission posted a video on Facebook featuring testimonials from tribal elders. One said he landed 20 sockeye.
I wasn't really expecting to get this much from dipping on the Kuskokwim. Something new for me, and it works good.
There still aren't enough fish returning to replace the missing stocks. But with Chinook too few to meet the need, sockeye are too plentiful to ignore. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Mat-Su Borough puts millions in settlement funds towards opioid treatment and prevention.
It's a chronic brain disease. It's progressive and deadly. And it's not a moral failing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life, getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope, there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share-your-strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Alaska mining projects like Pebble have drawn national headlines, but another large mine you've probably never heard of is quietly preparing to start production in the interior. Proponents of the Manh Choh gold mine point out that it will create hundreds of high-paying jobs in an area of the state that needs them. But critics say federal and state agencies failed to properly review the overall impact of the mine. They worry that failure sets a precedent for other mining projects in Alaska and the lower 48. For Alaska Public Media, Sean McDermott reports.
When Barbara Schumann first heard about Kinross, Alaska's plan to transport ore across the interior as part of a new mining project called Manh Choh, she was shocked.
It just seemed unbelievable that this would be taking place or be allowed without special permitting and safety considerations.
The company, who is the majority owner and operator of the mine, will use nearly 250 miles of public roads from Tetlin to Fort Knox, their existing mill near Fairbanks. Kinross's plan calls for 60 round trips per day, or a truck every 12 minutes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
I don't know if you know that road. It's the only road people in Tetlin and Tok and all those little communities down the Richardson and Alaska highways, that's the only connection they've got to hospitals and airports.
As KUAC recently reported, the trucks will begin rolling by the end of the summer on what the company is calling trial runs, which will initially be empty. Fully loaded, these specially designed double trailer trucks will weigh 80 tons. They are roughly the length of two humpback whales. The winding route is primarily two lanes with few passing lanes or pullouts. Schumann regularly drives along the section of the ore haul route that passes through the heart of Fairbanks, and she worries sharing the road will come at a cost for everyday Alaskans. And for her family, it's not an abstract concern. Her husband's mother, brother, and sister were killed years ago when a commercial truck hit them head-on.
I just think that safety should take precedence. Human safety should be number one. Not profits, it should be human safety. And I don't think it is for the people that we're dealing with.
Schumann's a retired lawyer, and when she didn't feel like the state was taking her questions about the project's safety seriously, she helped form the community group Advocates for Safe Alaskan Highways. They say there's been a general lack of transparency about the mine's potential toll on public safety and infrastructure. The Alaska Department of Transportation has fast-tracked replacing 5 bridges along the route and plans over $300 million of infrastructure upgrades that won't be complete before the ore haul begins. Kinross declined multiple requests for interviews for this story.
Manh Choh means big lake.
A promotional video the company posted online doesn't address the trucking plan. Instead, it focuses on the project's economic prospects.
Manh Choh is Kinross, Alaska's first operation on tribal land. And from the very beginning, the company has been keenly focused on doing it right for the people and the land.
But the mine's environmental review process has come under scrutiny too. Different federal and state agencies were responsible for various elements of the permitting process, but no agency is looking at the project's full impact. The Army Corps of Engineers was responsible for deciding the scope of the federal environmental review. Gregory Mazur is a project manager for the Army Corps. He says the Corps determined only a 5-acre area of wetlands would be permanently impacted by the dredging and fill for the new access road at Manh Choh.
So it was clear from the outset that this project was likely to not require an environmental impact statement.
But Manh Choh's ore is geochemically different from that at Fort Knox, where it will be processed, with the potential for centuries of acid generation.
I don't think any of us considered that as a potential impact, that they're bringing a different type of ore to the mill. So, yeah, I mean, that certainly, that was outside of our scope of analysis for this project.
Other federal agencies disagreed with the review process. In written comments, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service expressed numerous concerns for fish, wildlife, and waterways. The Environmental Protection Agency suggested a more thorough review of the full project, but that hasn't happened. Mike Spindler, a retired biologist in Fairbanks who has decades of experience with environmental reviews, says this kind of divided responsibility is becoming more common.
It's called segmentation of permits. That's a strategy. If you segment the permits to just little aspects of the big project and you don't look at the whole thing, then the impacts don't look as great. And so the public blowback isn't going to be as great.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service raised concerns that watersheds around both Manh Choh and Fort Knox, including Tetlin Lake, Toke River, and the Little Chena and Chena Rivers, could be impacted. Spindler says the lack of a comprehensive environmental review for the project is glaring.
I don't know how the conclusion could have been made that no EIS is required.
For some local residents in Toke, these questions pale in comparison to the opportunities the mine might bring. Bronk Jorgensen, whose log home looks out over the hills where the Manh Choh project is underway, says Kinross has been making sure smaller contractors like him can bid on jobs for the mine.
We are not a destination in Alaska. We are a pass-through town. So this will be the first real industry this community and area has seen on any scale.
Jorgensen acknowledges the increased truck traffic might be inconvenient, but says the community has already seen an economic boost.
The indirect economic benefits to the Toke area are going to be very significant. When you drive through town, you can already see the number of mine support vehicles that are parked at the hotels, at the restaurants, parts store, grocery store.
Kinross is leasing the land for Manh Choh from the native village of Tetlin, whose tribal council have expressed support for the project. The council did not respond to requests for interviews for this story. While Kinross estimates that Manh Choh will create 250 construction jobs and 300 to 600 mining and trucking jobs across the interior, Tetlin tribal member Larry Mark worries the benefits of those jobs, and from the mine itself, won't be distributed equitably to the native village of Tetlin.
You gotta benefit the tribe, benefit the people. Everything got to benefit them, you know, and it's got to be done right, and it's got to be in writing.
Community members also worry about the precedent the project could set for mines statewide. Jeff Benowitz is a Fairbanks-based geologist who's worked across the state. He thinks Kinross has done a good job at Fort Knox over the years, but bringing the potentially acid-bearing ore from Manh Choh changes things.
It isn't as much that I'm personally concerned that this is a hazard, I'm concerned that it's not being evaluated.
Benowitz explains that mining companies are currently eyeing many deposits along Alaska highways in order to use public roads for transporting ore, including the Parks and the Richardson, compounding the effects.
The reality is people don't care, but they're going to care when that's in their state and in their county. Once there's one truck, it's done. The precedent's been set.
Despite many unanswered community concerns, the Manh Choh mine is quickly moving forward. The company plans to start their full-scale truck hauling operation next summer. Reporting from the interior, I'm Sean McDermott.
This story was reported in collaboration with Lois Parshley for Grist Magazine and was supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. To see the online version with much more detail, visit alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Quality childcare creates futures for families, children, and the state's economy. When children are safe, engaged, and learning, parents can work and everyone has a better outcome. Thread has resources to support your family in their childcare search. Knowing what to look for in a licensed facility is important for the safety of your children. Thread also offers parenting resources and support. To learn more about quality childcare in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread.
The Mat-Su Borough Assembly unanimously passed a resolution to begin allocating $2.3 million of opioid distribution settlement funds last week. The borough has held three community meetings about how to use the funds wisely in Willow, Palmer, and Wasilla. Michael Carson is chair of the Mat-Su Opioid Task Force. He says based on the surveys, the grants will go to programs working on treatment, prevention, harm reduction, and recovery. Carson says that keeping the focus clear promises better outcomes.
It really focuses on those four specific areas. And I think that that will definitely get us a bigger bang for our buck and really be able to turn the corner on this epidemic.
The borough used public input to determine how to direct the funds. Based on that, they plan to allocate 30% of the funds to treatment, 30% to prevention, 10% to harm reduction, and 10% to recovery. All the funds will be focused on education and training. Carson says based on the comments shared by Mat-Su community members, it's clear residents have evolved in their thinking about the epidemic. In the past, some people have suggested that no money should be spent on the opioid epidemic, but Carson says this time there were almost no negative comments.
As time has gone, more and more families have been directly affected by the opiate epidemic. And I think what happens is people understand that it's a chronic brain disease, it's progressive and deadly, and it's not a moral failing.
The funds will be rolled out over 18 years. Each year, $50,000 to $150,000 will be distributed through up to 40 separate grants. Organizations will be able to apply for the funding under one of the focus areas, and they can also apply to renew grants. They'll have to report on exactly how the funds are used and on the outcomes of their work. Students from the University of Alaska Anchorage's Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP, will have increased opportunities for federal jobs after a partnership with the U.S. Department of the Interior. The Alaska Beacon reports that the agreement will streamline the application process for ANSEP students. The program started in the 1990s with one university student and has expanded to include 3,000 students as early as fifth grade. The agreement, which was signed this month, includes a, quote, direct hire authority, which means ANSEP students, after working for the state's university for a set number of hours and obtaining their degree, can be hired non-competitively for Department of Interior jobs for 2 years. A non-competitive hire doesn't have to compete with the general public for a job. The program has already worked with the Interior Department to place students in internships and full-time jobs with the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. The new partnership should open those opportunities to more students. The jobs are primarily in Alaska, Beth Spangler, a senior director with the program, says, but can be anywhere in the United States. The agreement takes effect immediately, but Spangler said in practice, it is likely to take off next season as a result of agencies making fall hires for next summer. Meanwhile, a seafood donation program that began in Sitka during the pandemic is still growing. Now called the Seafood Distribution Network, the program is supplying sockeye to families on the Yukon and Chignik rivers whose traditional salmon runs have crashed. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The market shift in seafood during the COVID pandemic created a problem for the industry. Unlike many other sectors, the supply, the fish, was still there. How to connect those fish with people when traditional markets vanished. For Linda Benkin, director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, it was about connecting the dots.
So we worked with the local processors here to figure out what fish was stranded by markets being closed, by restaurants being closed, the supply chain disruptions, raised money, bought fish from fishermen that was sort of stranded product, and then started distributing it to people in town that told us they were in need. So it was really, you let us know. If you need seafood, we'll provide it.
And that's how Alpha's seafood donation program got started in 2020. Basically, a processor-to-doorstep delivery service for people who were having trouble getting by. It didn't take long for word about the program to get out.
And then we started hearing from people outside Sitka that there was need and people really wanted seafood. So we did a distribution with Sea Alaska, for example, that reached every community in Southeast Alaska. And we did distributions in the lower 48 to tribes along the Columbia River, to Anchorage military families, to communities in Western Alaska. So sort of where we heard there was need, we found partners to work with. to make that happen.
Benkin credits Sitka-based processors, Seafood Producers Co-op, Sitka Sound Seafoods, and Northline Seafoods, along with tribes and tribal organizations across the state, for helping make the connections that kept the program going. On paper, it sounds like an impossible undertaking, delivering 645,000 seafood meals across the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, but Benkin says it conformed to basic Alaskan values.
Alaska is a big state, but we're also a small state, and the communities really care about other communities. We have a lot of relatives in different parts of the state, and that there is clear reason for us to share between those areas that have a lot and those areas of scarcity, but the infrastructure isn't really there. So that's what we've been working on developing, is that infrastructure in Alaska so Alaskans can benefit from Alaska's fish.
A grant from the Alaska Community Foundation got the seafood donation program rolling. A regional food systems grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture helped ramp it up. But just the energy of regular Alaskans is helping fuel things now. In a pilot project in Dillingham this June, Alpha organized a drive to collect subsistence sockeye for communities affected by the crash in Chinook and Chumstocks. Natalie Sattler is the program manager for Alpha.
We worked with a lot of community members and locals in Dillingham in the Bristol Bay area to help us collect seafood, and it was all subsistence donations, and within 1 week we were able to collect 5,000 pounds of sockeye, and folks were just, they rallied support, they went down to their set net sites and were just kids, families, everyone just, you know, picking fish and donating it and getting it ready to ship out.
This year, the sockeye will be going to communities on the Yukon and Chignik rivers, and besides providing food, Benkin says the fish are intended to keep food traditions alive.
What we've heard from people in these communities that aren't able to harvest fish themselves right now because of scarcity is that they really wanted round fish, because being able to process that fish as a family is, and as a community, is really culturally important.
The pandemic and the salmon crash have been a 1-2 punch for many communities in Western Alaska. In a news release, Representative Mary Peltola said programs like Alpha's Seafood Distribution Network were a critical part of the rebound. Low salmon abundance is an issue that needs to be addressed at every level, from the federal government down to individual communities, and efforts like this are an important piece of that larger goal, Peltola said. Reporting in Sitka with help from Brooke Schaefer, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rachel Cassandra, Kavitha George, and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Sean McDermott in Tok, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. We're glad to have you tuning in, and we'd love to welcome you as a member. Make a donation to this station and be a part of the public media family. Thank you. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.